Hello and welcome to This Is AI, a podcast dedicated to cutting through the hype of machine learning and artificial intelligence and simply looking at what it means for you.
Hi, welcome to This Is AI, our podcast with Gary and Jonathan. I'm Gary Pretty, Microsoft MVP in the field of AI, which means I spend a lot of my time innovating with new technology around AI and seeing how it can be used to impact people's lives in a positive way.
So I'm Jonathan Seal. I'm part of the British Interactive Media Association, that's BIMA's think tank on artificial intelligence. I also head up innovation at Mando, which is an organisation that uses digital tools and ideas to simplify people's lives. So if you're joining us for the first time this episode, well, hello. This podcast looks at the changing world of AI and digs into typically one part of it in a little bit more detail to understand how that might impact you. We've got some news from the world of AI since the last episode, and then we're going to be focusing on the topic of hyper-personalization. That sounds like some weird futuristic form of transport, but I promise you it's actually something you experience every day online. And AI is typically the thing that's powering that, so we'll talk about that more later. So Gary, before we get to the news, we were looking last episode at financial services. And obviously, if you're listening in now, please check out that episode. That was called Who Needs Banks When You've Got Emojis? If you haven't listened to that. One thing we mentioned at the end is that, Gary, you were heading to Orlando to be part of the annual Microsoft pilgrimage to Ignite, which is their massive conference. So apart from dodging hurricanes every other day, what was it about that mattered in terms of AI, and why should that be important to us normal mortals?
Yes, so I was one of the, I think there were around 40,000 people if you included all of the Microsoft folks over there. So it was a pretty huge conference. Over the last couple of years, Microsoft have evolved it to be their sort of primary messaging around many of their products. And I think the interesting thing this year was we saw the continuation of a theme, the theme of Microsoft and AI being one of their key pillars, going sort of now and looking at their sort of their road ahead in terms of the company that Microsoft will become. They were very keen to stress how now not only is AI one of their major pillars, but it's also infused into all of their technology. It's everywhere. And really highlighting that point, I think I found it really interesting that normally at these conferences, you'll have a major keynote at the start of the conference where they'll make lots of product announcements and point to, you know, product roadmap features. And this time I got the distinct sense that actually they saved a lot of the product announcements around more traditional services like Windows or Office for smaller sort of technology focused keynotes afterwards. And actually they held what was called a vision keynote right up front at the beginning of the conference, where they just focused primarily on AI, big data, machine learning, and the sort of the strides they're making in that. And it was from a very sort of high level perspective as well. It was, where are we seeing our technology impacting our customers?
And so I know that you're really keen on understanding how Microsoft sort of changes and their corporate structures and so on, but for the typical punter who's more interested in, you know, what's this going to do for them? How is this going to impact the person, man or woman on the street, and what they do every day? How does this influence that?
Yeah, so it's really everywhere that we look now. So even if you are, you know, someone who's primarily office-based, you don't really get involved in sort of AI in any sort of meaningful way from your perspective, actually we're starting to see this technology creep into those tools that you're using every day. So if we take Microsoft Office as an example, they were very keen to highlight things like the PowerPoint Translator, which is a new add-in for those people who deliver presentations using PowerPoint, which you can switch on, and then it will in real time take an audio feed from your microphone and translate that speech into text into one of a number of different languages. And then not only can you have the sort of closed captions on the screen, which has your speech in, you know, another language or maybe your own native language, but then people within the audience, and they did this for all of the sessions as well, were able to take out an app on their Android or Apple phone and download the app and connect that app to the session itself and say, well, actually, I want to see the closed captions in a different language. So you could, in theory, have, you know, 10 different people in the audience, each one of them having the app open, each one of them seeing closed captions in a different language in real time as they're being presented to, which is a huge deal for, you know, not only for Microsoft, you know, when they're putting on an international conference with people from all over the world, but you just think of the number of scenarios where people are presenting. You know, I could take this technology right now and do a presentation, you know, within the office or to a client and use exactly the same thing. And then we're also starting to see it happen more and more in the other tools within the Office suite. So as an example, the Word tool, we all use it. We all use spell check and grammar check. You know, up until now, it's been fairly basic, based on the same sort of same old rules. But there's sort of the word on the street is that that's going to become more intelligent as well as time progresses. And they're going to start to take advantage of some of their text analytics APIs and their cognitive services. And then finally, since Ignite, Microsoft have also announced that Cortana is coming to the Skype platform. So we've talked before on the show around bots being able to listen into your conversations and provide contextual or relevant help. And that's exactly what Cortana is intended to do. So if I'm talking to my colleagues about maybe plans at the weekend or maybe meetings that we need next week, Cortana will jump in at the most appropriate time, hopefully, and try and help you out. So yeah, it seems to be everywhere at the moment.
I love the idea, you're talking about Word before and applying cognitive services to Word. I love the idea of something like sentiment analysis, where you can tell sort of the emotion of the person who's writing. It's the Clippy coming back again, isn't it? We talked about this before.
Yes.
You can imagine Clippy coming and saying, it seems like you're writing a really angry letter. Would you like some help with that?
Yeah. Yeah. But if you think about it, you know, if you're trying to write an email, for example, to a customer, it's a fairly delicate email, or you know, you're writing some sort of a document and you want to, you know, get across a particular point, you can imagine that being able to have it analyze your sentiment, for example, as you're typing that document, so that you can actually go, oh, do you know what, I'm being overly negative here and I really don't want to do that. So you know, you can really see the real world opportunities.
And we saw something really similar, didn't we, with LinkedIn. Is it Crystal? I think they had this service where if you're signed up for it, it sort of analyzes the recipient of your message. If they've got a LinkedIn profile, starts looking at you know, how they're likely to receive the message and starts suggesting alternative phrasings that you could use for them, which is obviously, again, powered by those kind of insights and deep learning.
Yeah.
Excellent. Sounds fascinating. So the other thing that has been going on since last time we had a podcast was we've run an event with Mando on financial services. So we talked a lot about financial services last time, didn't we? And so we were running this event for Mando that was really a dinner event focused around financial services and the role that AI is playing in transforming and disrupting the world of financial services with AI. So we had a bunch of banks there, major banks, insurance providers, significant challenger brands all represented, and that was fascinating. So we've got a white paper coming out, so stay posted for that. I'm not going to steal its thunder because obviously it's still in the process of being written, but a few quick themes that did come out that I think it might just be worth touching on. Is one of them was around the idea that yes, AI is really important, but customer experience and great customer experience is always going to be king. We know that's been a driving factor of the way that brands are positioning themselves, but because of AI coming in, it's setting the bar so much higher. You know, people need to be, or expecting rather, to have so much a better and more personalized experience. And I know we're going to touch on that a little bit later on. You know, customers don't just want access to basic information. They want tailored insights, personalized service from the financial providers that they engage with. So that was one thing. And the second one was around the idea of these big banks being in a really precarious situation, because although they've got huge amounts of trust built up, they're really open to some of these challenger brands in terms of the way that they can leverage you know, insights and data in a way that these big players just aren't set up to do. So you look at the likes of some of the big banks, and while they are making great strides forward, they really are hampered by the way that their, you know, their big legacy technology systems are set up. So yeah, you know, fascinating insights there around that. And then the third, which I suppose links to it, is that you can see these organizations that have data at the heart of them really taking off. You know, you look at the likes of the Amazons of this world and the Apples, which, you know, have loads of either transactional data or behavioral data or location data and device data. Those kind of things are going to be absolutely key when you start saying, well, we can use this to offer you a personalized and a tailored service in the world of financial services.
Yeah, and I thought a really interesting point from my perspective was that traditionally a lot of these organizations that we were talking to already use AI, and more specifically machine learning, if we want to be specific about it, with AI being that big bucket that we throw everything into.
Yeah.
They're already using machine learning in a lot of ways internally. But actually, I think one thing, and again, I don't want to steal the thunder of the paper, but it was really obvious that actually there is, you know, a lot of benefits to be had in terms of that customer experience from using AI, from helping the customer have a more streamlined and efficient experience with that brand. And even though these organizations are already using many of these technologies in some areas of their business, there's still a huge seismic shift needed in many ways, because they just simply aren't necessarily on that path yet, or certainly not as far down as some of the disruptors within their own industry.
So let's move now to some of the news that's been happening over the last month in the world of AI. So Gary, do you want to start with your robot story of the month?
Yes, who doesn't love a good robot story? So so this caught my eye, and I thought it was really interesting because it harks back to some of the other things that we've been talking about on previous episodes. And this is around the Estonian government, who are starting to pull some legislature together to recognize robots as potentially their own independent legal entities. And actually, I think what they've said, the way they've positioned it, is they want to come somewhere in the middle between it being property that is owned by someone, so whoever's maybe building or controlling that particular robot, and it being part way towards it being its own legal entity in its own right. And I think the main driver behind this is, you know, as we've discussed in the past, as we move towards things like driverless cars or machine learning, or, you know, broader AI technologies controlling some of the critical things that we're doing in life, that also brings with it the need for some accountability. So if a driverless car makes a decision using machine learning and causes some sort of injury or causes an accident, who's responsible? Is it the AI? Is it the people who wrote the AI? Is it the people who provided the data? And that's what the Estonian government are trying to now put into some sort of legal context, so that they can almost say, well, actually, you know, in certain scenarios, if something goes wrong, it's not the person who's at fault, it is the AI itself. So I think this is, you know, it's very early days, it's just something that they've started talking about, but I thought it was really interesting that we're starting to see this required shift.
Yeah, and it's fascinating how we are genuinely moving towards that science fiction kind of mindset, you know, the Asimov's laws. And we even talked, I think it was last time, one of the news items then was around the German government trying to codify some of the thinking around driverless cars specifically. But as it broadens out and we start getting AIs operating in more and more parts of our lives, we're going to see this legislation, this thinking becoming more and more needed.
I've said before how science fiction from the past often mirrors where we are today. I'm a fairly big Star Trek fan. All I can think of when we talk about this topic is there was an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation where they effectively put Data the android on a trial to see whether he was the property of the Federation or he was an entity in his own right, and the whole episode effectively dealt with this subject. So once again, it just shows that, you know, science fiction from 20, 30, 40 years ago starting to rear its head in reality, which I think is fascinating.
Brilliant. Okay, so next news article that I wanted to pick up on. So this is the announcement that Amazon and Microsoft made recently about their new open source deep learning interface. So this sounds a little complicated and is. So they've called this thing Gluon, because obviously what you need when you're in a deep technology area is to bring another field of expertise in. So they've tied it with the idea of particle physics. But this whole point of this thing is around creating an open source area where you can get deep learning interfaces available for people to start using and getting learnings from, and leveraging that common interface across platforms. Now, if we apply the kind of who cares test to this, you really have to think, well, you know, why is this important? So if you forget about the specifics of this particular announcement, it tells us a lot more about the partnerships that are beginning to evolve and why they're important. So we talked, I think it was last time, about, again, one of the Amazon and Microsoft partnerships around the idea of Cortana and Alexa, because they were starting to announce that they'd tie in the skills together, and I'm sure you'll touch on that later, Gary. But one thing this represents is a deepening of that kind of relationship, because we're going to start to see more and more and more of a need for these services to tie together in a really coherent way. Because for AI to be useful, it can't just be about one particular thing that it can do, and then as soon as you go outside that area of expertise, it just gets lost horribly and can't cope. We need things that can sort of understand, right, I've reached the limit of my own understanding as an AI, I need to now hook into another service or another AI that can fill in the gaps for me, or daisy chain these things together and make something meaningful. So I think that's a really interesting one. I mean, in the same vein, just while we're on the topic of things hooking to other things, I was really happy to hear in this last month that there's been a final development that we've been waiting for between Amazon Alexa and the Sonos environment. So I'm a massive Sonos fan. I've got a bunch of Sonos speakers throughout my house, and also love the Amazon Echo and the Echo Dot. And so being able to actually have those things properly hooked together for the first time, so I can say, you know, please play me Taylor Swift in the kitchen, and it will happily do that for me. And I do say play Taylor Swift in the kitchen. But you know, that is a brilliant opportunity to then get this thing working, and it feels so much more joined up than these weird things where you have to sort of ask it to do something and open another skill and all that kind of stuff, which we are seeing at the moment.
Yeah, things you learn on a podcast. We've obviously got more things in common than we thought, because I ask Google to play Taylor Swift in the car. So
awesome.
Moving on to sort of the next topic, and it seems to be every single time we record one of these episodes, we always end up with a story like this around a government or a large organization starting to use machine learning or deep learning for nefarious purposes, with the veil of positivity. And this episode is the turn of the Chinese government, who have announced that they would like to start using machine and deep learning algorithms to predict crimes before they happen. So
we haven't heard that in science fiction before at all, have
no,
we?
Not at all. You know, anybody who remembers the Minority Report film with Tom Cruise, you will already know what this story is all about, because that's effectively what they're suggesting they'd like to do. They want to be able to start using things like image recognition and location-based data to try and determine the likelihood of somebody committing a crime. So if somebody visits a gun shop or visits certain locations on certain days. And now obviously in isolation, none of these things necessarily mean that the person is going to commit a crime. But the Chinese government really believe, with all the data they have, they are able to collate this information and use machine learning and sort of deep learning algorithms to try and predict when someone is going to commit a crime. And the way in which they actually phrased it was the software would learn and see patterns as their citizens are moving around within their daily lives, and that should somebody's propensity to commit a crime, according to the AI, increase beyond a certain threshold, then the police could intervene. For me, it's a dangerous place to be going.
You genuinely couldn't make it up, could
you? No, absolutely. It's a very dangerous path that they're going to potentially start moving down. But one of the big problems, as I see it, is China effectively don't really have any effective data protection laws in terms of the government. So the government can collect and use data in any way that they see fit. So there really is nothing stopping them. But again, it all comes back to the idea of, you know, bias within AI and the people who are building that software, what biases they're actually building into it, and how accurate is it going to be. So yeah, very interesting story, I think, and probably more to come next time.
I can imagine every single episode we're going to have some kind of the dark side of AI aspect to it. So I suppose, keeping with the Minority Report theme, we talked about some of the potential for advertising. One of the things that I've seen over this last month is a Wired article around Piccadilly Circus and the advertising screens that they have up there. Because although they've been in place for, you know, some time, I think it's, you know, from the 90s, they've had LED screens up there, but But increasingly, they're starting to make these smarter. And one of the interesting announcements that got made recently was that they're actually going to be building in some AI aspects to that, and starting to do some really interesting where they will look at passing vehicles. So in this case, looking at the make, model, color of a car passing by, and based on that, they can actually target advertising to that vehicle. So, you know, again, as we saw in the film, in the science fiction sort of genre, we see, you know, very personalized adverts being, you know, broadcast straight to your retina. Here we're starting to move in that direction. You know, if you're in a Honda wandering down the street and it happens to be a trigger point for this billboard advertising, then it would kick in and give you some kind of advertisement. Now, at the moment, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that pans out in terms of A, effectiveness, but also, you know, what are the kinds of adverts that are likely to be displayed. But given how, you know, how much background we've got in that with things like Google and the way that they personalize and tailor adverts, or Facebook or Twitter, it's only a matter of time before that gets even more deeply personalized.
So that really does lead us on nicely to our main topic, John. So we're going to talk about hyper-personalization. So I think it's probably a good place to start if you would give us a definition of what you see hyper-personalization as being.
Okay, so I'll give a pretty rambling description. But if we think about how businesses historically, you know, went to market and marketed to people, it started off, you know, pretty broadcast kind of model. It's, you know, in a fairly unsophisticated way. It's like this is what we sell, or this is what we do. There you go. Now, introducing over time the idea of market segmentation, so you would start to find groups that were useful to you for different purposes. You'd sort of say, well, this demographic, this geography, whatever it happens to be, you'd group people together and say, we're going to segment and market in that kind of way, so we can tailor our messages to different groups of people. Now, hyper-personalization really takes that to the sort of the infinite degree, where you're essentially throwing away the model of market segmentation and saying that really the market size is one unique individual always. So that means that what you're trying to do is wrap your product and service offering around that individual, and then do everything you need to do in order to understand them deeply so that you can market effectively to them. Now, you know, if you think about you know, a couple of hundred years ago, if I had a shop and I was running that grocery store, say in an 18th century village, then it would be very easy for me really to understand, you know, all of the individuals who would come into my shop, and I could understand their life history, I'd understand the kinds of things they liked, I'd probably know a lot about their circumstances and the way that they operate and the rhythm and pattern of their lives. And so I'd be able to service them really, really effectively. But of course, we don't live in in a grocery store in an 18th century village. We live in a global market. And so being able to do that kind of understanding of an individual at scale requires huge amounts of data and huge amounts of effort that we then apply to tailoring products and services for those customers. So hyper-personalization, in a very rambling definition, is really about making all the things necessary and in place so that you can tailor those products and services for an individual customer and at the scale of a kind of global market. Now, one of the things that's I suppose interesting about that is that then AI plays a huge role in making that possible, because you could employ teams and teams of people to sit, you know, behind computer screens, and whenever anyone comes onto the website or onto an online service, try and figure out about them, try and investigate their social media profiles, and then do something as a result of it. But that becomes very expensive and very messy and very inefficient very quickly. So AI really is about saying, what can we do to bring those insights together, interpret them, and do something meaningful? Now, we see this every day, because every time you go to the likes of Amazon, every time you go on Google and you see Google adverts, every time you go onto Netflix, you're seeing the results of that kind of hyper-personalization, because it's looking at you, everything it understands about you from every micro-interaction that you've done over all of your relationship with that organization, and then doing something with that to hopefully add value. Because obviously what they're looking for in those organizations is to try and get a better outcome for themselves and for the individual. So some of the benefits might be, well, I can make better specific offers to them. I can increase engagement. I can increase conversion. I can increase loyalty. So those are really, really interesting things that we know we can do with hyper-personalization and using AI.
One thing we've been seeing over the last months and maybe a couple of years is the expansion of some of these capabilities and opening them out to not just the big players, but the everyday users, to allow you to use some of the AI or you certainly use some of those sorts of hyper-personalization techniques within your own life. So I myself have got a Philips Hue light plugged into my porch, and I can turn it on and off using my app on my phone, internet connected, it's fantastic. But actually what I've actually chosen to do is to hook up the Hue service to the If This Then That service, which then as I pull up the driveway, it detects that my phone detects that I've arrived at home, and it will turn the light on if I am after sort of sunset. So that for me is my idea of hyper-personalization from my perspective. We're also seeing the same sort of capabilities being made available to everyday sort of business users as well. So if you think anywhere from a small business up to an enterprise, we're starting to see similar sorts of capabilities. So a great example is Microsoft have a product called Flow, which is almost like their next generation workflow software, where you can chain different steps and different activities together. But as part of those flows, you can actually call out to various cognitive services. So using language understanding or sentiment analysis, sentiment detection. So an email arrives, I can then choose to run some sentiment analysis on that. And then depending on the score that I get back, I can fire that off to the most appropriate people within the business. So if it's a very negative email and it goes beyond a certain threshold of negativity, I might choose to bump that to the top of the list and send that to a manager to have that being dealt with. But I think what it probably does is what we're not seeing yet is the ability for it. It's still all very siloed. And I think if we start to look at some of the limitations around hyper-personalization and how we can get there, the big one as I see it is this idea of data silos. So, you look at Amazon, for example. Amazon will have a very, very good understanding of me, of my browsing habits in terms of browsing around the site, the products that I'm interested in, the products that I've bought. And therefore, when I visit Amazon, I get some really, really nicely targeted, oh, here's some products that we recommend for you, or here are some things that you were looking at, this time last year. So these are probably most, going to be appropriate for you. As we approach Christmas, that's going to become more and more obvious for every one of us who are using Amazon to do some of our shopping. The problem as I see it though is Amazon are really good at understanding me from an Amazon perspective. But actually, if I go onto Amazon and I spend 3 weeks browsing through the site trying to find the perfect book that I'm going to use for my sort of next project, or that I'm going to be sort of diving into for the next few months, and then I go offline and I go into a Waterstones and I buy that book, I then go back to Amazon and it's still giving me the same personalization. And I think what we're seeing now are lots of examples of hyper-personalization where it's restricted because of the amount of data that particular entity holds about me and the amount of context that they have. It's a walled garden.
It doesn't get your whole context. I mean, one of the classic things that you've just mentioned there about Amazon, what would be a really compelling experience would be if you order something from Amazon, your Amazon delivery knows obviously where you live, but also has access to your smart lock on your front door and your Philips Hue light to turn the porch light on for when the delivery driver is able to, on a one-time code, come into your house. That's where it becomes joined up, and at the moment it still feels like we're quite some way away from that. The other angle, I suppose, on that same idea of the limitations is that scenario that I just described there could be seen as really, really empowering and useful, or could be seen as incredibly creepy and incredibly violating of what feels safe and normal. What's your take on that?
I guess I'm probably one of the outliers, as you probably are as well, because I think we have a good understanding of how these things work, or certainly a high level understanding rather than understanding the algorithms behind the scenes. But anything for me that gives me more targeted content. You know, if I can visit Amazon and I can see something that's meaningful to me that I'm actually looking for, it's going to streamline my experience. I'm going to be really happy about that. And I will understand potentially as they start to integrate other services where that data is coming from. So for example, if Amazon did pop up with some relevant context based on, you know, some sort of shopping experience that I've had, and they've used data from my smartphone through an Amazon app, for example, and therefore they're able to say, well, actually, it looks like you visited the bookstore, so we're not going to recommend those books to you anymore, I'm going to be really pleased. I think the everyday person, though, who doesn't necessarily understand where that data is coming from, is going to be pretty creeped out by that. And certainly, all the evidence so far shows that people don't necessarily like it when they don't really understand how somebody's made that decision. They don't like the idea that these businesses sort of have a window into their life without them necessarily saying, yes, you can have a window into my life. And quite often, it's very hard to even remember when you gave that permission.
Sure. So we've spoken before now about the idea that, you know, these devices, these systems that we use are spawning this kind of cloud of data that just surrounds us. This is almost like an exhaust, huge exhaust that's like leaving behind every time we go anywhere and do anything online. That's meaning that we're creating this vast amount of data, and while that data is incredibly powerful for organizations to use to then do this kind of hyper-personalization, because you need that volume of data and you need that velocity of data, we also need to be mindful that this is people's often private information and private details that are being spewed out into the ether, and a lot of people just aren't particularly careful with how they do that. So yeah, huge challenge there. We also know, I guess, that what is creepy now can become very, very ordinary and accepted in a couple of years' time. If we're on that adoption curve, if you like, then yes, you might be an early adopter, but you can guarantee that in a few years down the line, people are going to find it a lot more normal to have that kind of tailored advertising and so on that bleeds into the real world as well as online.
I think, regardless of where we think, as you say, you know, what's considered creepy now is considered normal further down the line. I think regardless of what you think or what I think, this is happening. It is going to happen, and we are going to reach this state where more and more all of the experiences that I have online or digital experiences will be able to take that information from various different touch points in my life. And I think that we're starting to see that now with some of the larger players. So if you look at Google, for example, you know, Google, I think, now have something like over 2 billion active smartphones in people's pockets, and they are actively trying to make their smart assistant, the Google Smart Assistant, understand more about a user's context, where they are, where they've been, what they've been doing online. And if you think about all of the different touch points that you have with your smart device, or when you're logged into a Chrome browser on your PC, if you've got GPS enabled, Google have a really good impression of what I've been doing, where I've been, and what, you know, activities I've probably been carrying out. One thing that I was absolutely stunned to see, and I don't know why I was stunned to see this, but it still shocked me, was my dad actually said, oh, have you seen the location services in the Google Maps app? And I said, well, no, you know, I know that Google Maps uses GPS. And he said, well, have you seen the history tab? And I went in and had a look at the history tab, and the history tab can show me for any given day since I turned my smartphone on, the route I've taken, where I've been, all the locations I've been to, which photos I took in that location. So you can imagine taking all of that data and being able to build up a picture of, you know, where do I turn up every day? You know, you look at a smart assistant, Cortana or Google Home, they will very quickly, once you've started using them, start asking you, oh, do you work at this location? Because you're here every day from sort of 9 until 5, so I'm assuming you work here. Can you just confirm it for me? So I think we're starting to see this hyper-personalization with larger platforms like Google and Cortana or Siri. And I think what we're the next step almost is the ability to have these platforms act as the the underpinning for the solutions going forward. So if you can imagine, I can build some Cortana skills, which I can hook into maybe some third-party data services within the enterprise, within the business, to make our employees' lives easier. But imagine being able to take the context that Cortana understands about that user, given the right permission, such as whereabouts are they right now? So I can actually start to take advantage of data that previously I would never have had. I have no way of gathering that data other than asking the user, where have you been? Mm-hmm. But actually, if we can start to hook into the vast amount of data that these companies already hold about us, we can build some compelling experiences. But I think regardless of what people want, that's where we're going.
You're edging there into some of the potential downsides of this, because you can imagine situations along the lines you just described where being able to understand exactly where someone's been could cause all sorts of complications, or being able to sort of splat out your what you've a personalized advert for you then in a physical location where you weren't expecting it. That could equally be quite awkward or embarrassing. So how does that play out? How can it go wrong?
Here you can look to something that we've all been very used to over the last few years. If you think about your credit report, so we've been using machine learning and sort of deep learning within the industry of credit scoring for a long time, using all of the data that they know about you, your account, your spending habits, etc. How many payments have you got up to date? Have you missed any payments? And they use these deep learning algorithms to determine our credit score. But I'm sure that many of the people listening, myself included, have had instances where maybe there's something on the credit report that's erroneous, and therefore that will impact your credit score, which then impacts my buying abilities and my buying power, be that for something small or very large, like life-changing mortgage, type large. And I think if we, you just have to look at how that can so easily go wrong with just a couple of pieces of erroneous data being in the mix, and can really have some huge impact on somebody's life. If you take that and then put that on a hyper scale and you say, okay, well, this, we're not just talking about the silo of your spending habits and your spending history, we're talking about your entire life and your location, your friends, who are you working with. We've already seen recently that Microsoft are working very heavily on what's called the Microsoft Graph, which now connects not only all of the Microsoft services, but things like LinkedIn as well. So actually, I can go and query, given the right permission, I can say, who are the people that I work with the most? What documents have they been working on? It's this mesh of data, and I can actually traverse this data to try and gather insights about me. But only a couple of those pieces of data need to be erroneous for me to make the wrong decision. And it's in that decision making. It's not necessarily that the data is even wrong. It's about the assumptions that we make because of that data. I think you can immediately see some downsides there.
Yeah, and following that exact same point, we know that when an AI is involved and has a particular outcome in mind, then that can lead to some particularly odd outcomes, or sometimes negative outcomes, even if they're explainable. If you only have to look at the likes of your Facebook, your social media feeds every day, they are driven by algorithms which look and say, what's going to get engagement from this person, what are the things that I should be prioritizing within their feed. All that kind of stuff is absolutely driven by an algorithm which its sole purpose is maximize engagement time. And one of the outcomes of that, if you leave that run to its natural conclusion, is we get the social media echo chamber effect, which we all experience in our own world, but has led to some pretty significant outcomes on a world stage, and we can't underestimate the importance of making sure that when we talk about hyper-personalization and the impact that some of these tools and services can have on our lives, that we're very aware of how we should be using them, how we should be regulating them, how we should be informing the way that personalization operates. Because it would be very easy to say, yes, great, we should always bring in some additional mix into that so that you're not always seeing an echo chamber of your own making. But that has huge implications in terms of drop off of engagement for Facebook, and they're not going to like that. So there are some pretty thorny areas that we need to explore over the coming months and years.
Yeah, and I think personally, it's I don't want to coin a phrase, but I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, almost.
I can guarantee you haven't coined that phrase.
No. So, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, we look when Amazon first launched, and they, you know, right now they might be very good at targeting adverts to me, and yeah, they still get it wrong sometimes, but 99% of the time, the adverts are in context, they're timely, very targeted. But actually in the early days, you know, people would log into Amazon and just be like, why on earth are you recommending that particular product for me? You know, you expand that out into your everyday life, and, you know, you have AIs making decisions for you. You know, let's forget advertising. Let's think about something, you know, more everyday, like driving or driverless cars, or the content that's being fed to me from a very important, maybe it's an AI making investment decisions for me. We need to be really, really mindful of it. And unfortunately, I don't think there's anything that you or I are going to be able to do about it. I think it's we're going to have to go through some pain, I think, as a society. But I think once we've been through that, the lessons that we learn, we will eventually get to a point where this stuff is really, really useful.
I was just struck by a really random thought that you can imagine a driverless car is powered by Amazon recommendations. So you turned left before. Would you like to turn left again? How unuseful that would be. Okay, so we don't end on a negative. Let's just wrap up by covering what we're up to over the next month or so. So Gary, what are you doing? Where are you out and about?
So at the end of the month, I am on the back of Ignite. Microsoft are holding their annual Future Decoded conference, which is their main UK conference for technical people and for business decision makers. This year they're running 2 days with several tracks, one of them being AI, and I'll be speaking. I've got a session on day two on the 1st of November around cognitive services in action, so seeing how we can use some of these services that we've talked about on this episode and previous episodes, so things like language understanding and intelligent FAQs, and seeing how they can be applied in real world situations now to improve the customer experience. So looking at it from how can we improve the experience and use technology as an enabler? So that's what I'll be doing later in the month.
Great stuff. So if you are in business and you fancy going to Future Decoded and listening to Gary, then please do make your way there. I can guarantee it will be a fascinating insight into how some of these amazing AI services can become practically applied to your business. So I am, a little bit later on this month, I am chairing a panel for the British Interactive Media Association's Artificial Intelligence Unit. So that's the Scotland part of that. So I'm going to be chairing this forum on looking at what AI is capable of beyond the sort of chatbot sphere. So that's fascinating, really looking forward to that. There's some great panelists. So have a search for that. And if you're up in that area, up in Glasgow, then please do come and have a look. So that's it. That's it for our podcast.
Yep, that's it for episode 3. Thank you very much for listening. Please do remember to share and rate the podcast if you've enjoyed what you've heard. You can also follow me on Twitter at Gary Pretty, and you can follow John at @J_Seal.
At @JAY_SEAL. You've been listening to This Is AI, a podcast brought to you by Mando with Gary Pretty and Jonathan Seal. You can follow us on Twitter. Just search for This Is AI, and please remember to share and rate the show. Join us next time, and thanks for listening.